Welcome to another segment of Open House here at Community Media. I'm Raymond Galker. This is a show where we bring great people from our community into our studio, and we talk about the great things that you're doing to make Adams and York County a great place to live. And we have a special open house in that we have, I don't know if he's the founder, we'll find that out.
Yes.
the founder of the most famous Civil War
string band.
And his name is Joe Yours.
Yes, sir.
Joe, thanks for agreeing to be interviewed. I mean, you came to our station here to coordinate some details with a fundraising event that you have coming up with the Lomas Center Museum. And I believe that is going to be November the 15th.
Yes, sir.
At 8 o'clock at the Gettysburg Middle School.
Yes, sir.
And Joe, you are with the 2nd South Carolina String Band.
Yes, sir.
You're not only with it, but...
I've been the business manager and banjo player since August, somewhere between the 3rd and the 5th. It was the 5th, I think. It was the first time that the band ever played together in 1989 at a place called Fort Warren in Boston Harbor. Fort Warren is on on an island, the name of which suddenly evaporated. On an island in Boston Harbor, it was built in 1855, and was used during the Civil War as a prison for politicians and Confederate officers mostly. And towards the end, I think it was used for deserters or something. But we belonged to an outfit called the Union and Confederate Veterans. It was like a reenactor thing where we had Federal reenactors and Confederate reenactors, and they would go there the first weekend in August every year and do a living history in the fort. And we camped in the fort all night, Friday night, Saturday night. It was absolutely amazing and wonderful. And so the first time that we went there, we had met, but none of us had actually played together. I knew that Dave, our lead guitar player and singer, I just knew he played guitar. And I knew I played banjo. And my brother, who wasn't involved with this until that weekend, played fiddle, violin. And so I said to Dave, bring your instrument, I'll bring my banjo, and I'm gonna get my brother to come out because it's gonna be awesome, it's gonna be great. And so that first night that we were there was the first night, or maybe it was a Saturday night, we played. All the guys were sitting around a fire, and there was a lot of loudness and, you know, conviviality going on. And so we retreated behind this large bush. And I remember being able to see the light from the fire through the bush, but it was basically, you know, silhouetted black. And we're sitting on one side and we're playing songs that Dave remembered all the words to, but they were songs that people of our age, my age, remember from grade school. Dan Emmett songs, you know, old Dan Tucker, Oh Susanna, Camptown Ladies. These were songs that we knew when we were children.
Doodah.
Yeah, give me a doodah. So that was how the band began. And then it grew from there. I remember the second year that we were out there, somebody asked us if we could play for a dance. The buildings were all made of granite, and the rest of the whole fort is made of granite. And one of the galleries had been designated during the war as a bakery. It was a very large room, all made of granite. And some of the ladies that were out there with their husbands and stuff thought maybe we could have a dance. And so somebody asked us, you guys play for a dance? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, we play. If you could dance to it, that'll be great. You know, good, that'll work. And so we had this little dance there. And the next day, I was walking around in the fort, and our sergeant was walking past me, and he said, "You know, you guys ought to make a tape." And I thought, really? Because at that point, this was in 1989, this was the third year of the 125th anniversary of the Civil War, and that was really the time that the hobby of Civil War reenacting had sort of exploded. And there were a lot of people, and the Ken Burns Civil War documentary had been released around that time, during that time. And so it was, you know, kind of a cool thing to do. And so I thought, well, yeah, maybe. And so we started rehearsing, and we put together a tape, because in those days it was audio cassettes, and there were two other groups that were Bobby Horton from Birmingham, Alabama. He had several tapes out already, and the 97th Regimental Band from Florida. They had a number of tapes out there, and they had been doing it for 2 or 3 years already. So we were, you know, like latecomers to this. And so we recorded this. Now, Dave was working at the House of Seven Gables at the time as the director of guides there. So he has a deep museum background, just like Michael does. And so on the campus there, I mean, Dave was living on the campus. They part of his compensation was to live in one of the buildings there with his family. And so we took one of the rooms downstairs. We started rehearsing. And over the winter of 1990-91, we rehearsed enough songs to make a tape. And then we recorded part of it there, and we recorded part of it in the basement of the house that my son and his roommates were renting at the University of Massachusetts, a literal basement tape, borrowed an 8-track tape recorder from a friend, and that was the first one. We released the album in August at Fort Warren in 1991, and the first two were sold to my wife, whose name I did not know at the time. I didn't know her name. She wouldn't tell me her name, but
this was before you were married.
She bought the first two tapes, and I still have them. Uh-huh. And so that was the beginning of it. 2 years later, we made another one, and we were kind of off to the races at that point, so to speak. And we released our third album, Southern Soldier, in 1996, in July of 1996, here in Gettysburg. And we had been hired to do a concert for the Civil War Institute at Gettysburg College that weekend. And so that was a big deal. And the album Southern Soldier is, with the first two that we did, now constitutes 70% of all of our sales, download, streaming, CDs, whatever. And now CDs are kind of like going the way of the Dodo and the 8-track and the audio cassette and this, so forth. So that's how that all got going.
So there was two other bands that were already committed to this. They had their vision. Did they play the exact same music that you did?
Well, the 97th Regimental they were Yankees. They did Yankees. And Bobby Horton did both sides, but Bobby Horton is a professional musician who played, was already involved in a very successful career with a group called Three on a String, which was kind of not pop music, but they did whatever it was somewhat comedic, and they played on the riverboat tours on the Mississippi sometimes. Anyway, Bobby had started releasing. He did a Confederate one, and then he did a Union one, and back and forth like that. He had three or four out before we even started. and eventually became a, you know, we competed with them over the years. Bobby, you know, Bobby did all, he made played all the instruments, and he played many more songs than we did. When we began, we did we just started with what we what I termed humorously as the top 30 of the Civil War. They're the ones the most popular, the most well known to the public. Mm-hmm. And then as when we got into the third album, a lot of things had changed in the way that we were approaching the music, and we discovered the most popular music among the troops during the War Between the States, which turned out to be from the minstrel stage. And so we started mining that streak, you know, and that became, and we started playing some instrumentals, melodies that people were familiar with, like Arkansas Traveler, and things like that, and it just, it went on from there. It just.
So, you were a reenactor before 1989.
Nope, had not heard of Civil War reenacting until. It was 1987. My profession was a children's book illustrator.
Is that right?
I was doing Sesame Street books, and I'd gotten some contract work from Disney to do stuff for product, you know, development, stuff like that, and I needed some help. So I'd hired a woman, I was going to interview a woman to do some help, you know, give me some help on this. She came out to my studio where I was living, and I was on the phone with somebody. So she's walking around, looking at the books and stuff that had pictures of the reenacting stuff from on the walls. And when I finally hung up, she said, "I see you got a lot of Civil War books and pictures and stuff." And she said, "I said, are you a reenactor?" She goes, "Yeah, I'm with the Mudsills, or had been with the Mudsills, which was an authentic, to which I would say campaign style. They, you know, they were very much rougher than the kind of reenacting we'd been doing." And she said that, so she had done that. And I said, "Oh, really?" And she said, "Yeah, last year we did Manassas." And I knew what Manassas was. And she said, it was 108 degrees for 5 days. "And you were there 5 days?" "Yes." "How many troops?" "About 8,000. And I was like, "Wait a minute, we just went through the 250th anniversary of the Revolutionary War. We'd seen, you know, we knew about those reenactments. If they got 500 to 1,000 people for one of those things, it was like huge." Mm-hmm. "And this was in that kind of weather? Are you kidding?" So this was in summertime when I interviewed her, and I found out how to find out more about it. And there was a sort of a publication called Camp Chase Gazette that she told me that I could get. So I got that. I realized that there was going to be the Antietam event in 87, but there's no way I could go to that. So I decided to come down in July of 88 to see the reenactment here. That was it. I was here for all 3 days. Oh, just blew my mind. And it turns out Bob Beeman, our percussion guy, Bones and Tambourine, he was there separately at the same time, and he had the same reaction that I did. It was like, okay, I have to do this. And I had my two boys with me, and they said, "Well, you can't do that without us."
And this was in 88.
This was in 88. And so I found out at that point that there was a Confederate unit in New England, the 2nd South Carolina Volunteer Infantry. I said, "That's perfect. Well, they're kind of rough, these guys." I said, "Oh, well, whatever. You know, I want to be a Confederate." I'd been a Confederate, and I think everybody in the band would agree to this. They'd been of a Confederate mindset militarily, no politics at all, because we all came across it in like the fifth grade. That's when, at our age, they used to teach about those things, and I learned about Pickett's Charge, and you know, the imagination takes over, and wow, none of the bloody and all of that. It's just like, wow, heroic, you know, carry the flag. And we lost, but only by that much, and that kind of thing. And so we all wanted to be Confederate. And so we all signed up with the second separately, or were recruited, as in my brother's case, and found out a little bit about each of us over a period of time from between 1988 and early 1989, when we started drilling in, you know, different places and meeting the other guys in the unit. And we carried the musket, quote unquote, for 10 years. And then played a dance, played in the camp. You know, after the dance, we'd come back to the camp and we'd play, you know, for our buddies around the campfire.
When did you pick up the banjo first?
That's an interesting question. I've been thinking about that lately. The first musical interest that I had was in honky tonk piano. There was when I was like 10. I had a record. My cousin, my one and only that I actually knew cousin, Mike, was a stride piano player in a jazz band out of Detroit, and really good. And so I had heard him play, and then this honky tonk piano record was just really cool. And then along came, you know, the Ballad of Jed Clampett on the Beverly Hillbillies. Mm-hmm. That was my first introduction to Earl Scruggs. I'm like, whoa, that's really interesting. And that was very exciting. And not long after that, the Dillards started showing up on Andy Griffith's show and playing hillbilly, you know, band up in the woods and stuff. And because Griffith played the guitar, and okay, so that was it. I wanted to be able to play the banjo, and we were going into the folk music craze at the same time. I mean, the Kingston Trio and all of that.
And how old are you at this time now?
I'm in high school. Okay. Kind of this thread that holds all this stuff together, the banjo and the Civil War. We moved from Illinois to Massachusetts in 1956 when I was 12. Just before we moved, some very close friends of my father's, the husband was a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge, and he was one of the guys who was the replacements, just got thrown in there, that had not fought all the way across till there yet. Very gentle person. They were aware of my Civil War proclivities at the time, because all the Western heroes on the TV, most of them were at some point or another in the script that you would find out they were former Confederates. So that was another influence. He gave me a book, The Last Cavalier, about Jeb Stuart. I said, wow, that's, you know, this is just as great. So come to Weston, Massachusetts. It's like going from one planet to another, a complete culture shock. But by the time I reached my senior year, I was well acclimated and had managed to rise through the ranks to the point where, for some unknown reason, I was able to convince my class to, instead of buying a bench or, you know, a bush or something like that, let's put on a Civil War pageant. So we rented uniforms and all this stuff all set up. It was fantastic. The principal chickened out. He was going to get life to cover it, because we were going to do it on the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the Civil War in April of 1961. And we did the pageant, and that was really cool.
And you were playing the banjo?
No, I wasn't playing the banjo. I was playing, like, I don't know, Stonewall Jackson or something. But that year, though, we had the senior variety show, which was a tradition. And the lead-off act, now I played like one of the co-MCs, and my shtick was to do covers of Jonathan Winter's routines or something. But the lead act for the thing was like cloaked in secrecy. And there were three guys in my class I was friends with, and they'd been working on whatever they'd been working on, but nobody knew what it was until that night of the dress rehearsal, the Friday night. So I did my shtick. I'm sitting in the audience. The curtain opens up, and here's these three guys, a guitar, an accordion, and a ukulele. And they launch into, there's a meeting here tonight by the Limelighters. The hair on my head and my arms just went straight up in the air. It was electrifying. I have to do that. I have to be able to do that. Now, I just wanted to play banjo. There was nobody to teach me how to play bluegrass banjo. Well, there were, but I didn't think they were approachable. They were like gods. In the Boston folk scene, there were several first-class, world-class banjo players playing in Cambridge and in the Boston area in those days, but I was afraid to approach them. So I didn't. I borrowed a banjo. I messed around with it. I could play fingerstyle guitar, but I just could not, you know, and until 1968, when Earl Scruggs published his book, How to Play Five, you know, Bluegrass Banjo. And that's when I began to learn how to.
You taught yourself?
I taught myself how to play banjo.
And that was in 65?
68. I started teaching myself in 1968. And my brother and I used to play for our parents, and we had a little band that was fronted by the guy that was a guy in Wellesley, Massachusetts that owned a music store. He was also from originally from Weston, and my brother was working for him for a number of years. I taught banjo for him for a few years, you know, just for kind of like pin money, extra money.
So you were able to pick it up?
Yeah. And so I, my brother and I think we maybe for 20, 25 years we played banjo for, you know, my folks. I learned different songs. We did a few recordings, but nothing that, you know, we ever tried to sell or anything.
So you started to reenact.
In 89.
In 89. And when you started to reenact, you took the banjo with you.
Yep.
And then you just play around the campfire.
Right. This guy who owned the Wellesley Music Center, he was able to get for me a Gibson copy Japanese banjo. It was unbelievable. It had a clear plastic head. It sounded amazing. And, you know, he got it for me for a discount. And so I was playing that, and that's the only banjo I had. And so we'd go out to the reenactments, and Dave had a dreadnought style Yamaha guitar. I had this, you know, Japanese bluegrass banjo. A violin is a violin is a violin, you know, is a fiddle. Fred's instrument is, well, not timeless, but, you know, there's no questioning the authenticity of it. And so that was the core. And we had a military drummer, John Fraler, who was a Vietnam vet. He played drum, and Bob Beeman played tambo and bones and stuff eventually. And that was the core of the band for 10 years. And in 1992, Laura, my wife, and I got married at Fort Warren. After a sort of a whirlwind romance kind of thing, we were married there. And 4 years later, we bought a home here in Gettysburg. She made the down payment on it. It was like a dream come true. 1820 Old Harrisburg Road, we restored the home to how it looked in 1855. Log home, we put a period style barn on it. Put a log addition on it, and we were very happy for 14 years. Just wonderful,
and
wonderful place.
What year was this now?
We bought the home in 1996, and here's.
This is about the time your third record came out, or album.
Yeah, actually, that's true. it turns out, in retrospect, that we bought the house on Friday of Remembrance Day. We closed. This show is going to be on Friday, Remembrance Day, 2024. I haven't done the math, but that's 20 some odd years later. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty special. One more thing about this house. When I told you we moved from Illinois to Massachusetts in 1956, we stopped here in 1956 for 2 days and a night. And, you know, we went to the Charlie Weaver thing and we bought the square foot of Gettysburg, you know, for preservation and stuff like that. And of course the interstates didn't exactly exist. They were just getting started in this country. So we drove on just, you know, two-lane roads mostly from Illinois to Massachusetts, passing through Gettysburg. On the day that we left, I remember it was overcast, and we drove out on the old Harrisburg Road towards Harrisburg. We passed this house, and it was, we'd been living in Gettysburg for maybe 3 or 4 years before it dawned on me what this was. As we passed this house, now I'm 12 years old, I'm sitting in the back of the car, and I'm watching, as we drive by this house, the windows were full of corn cobs. It's like, and I said to my, you know, this house is full of corn. Can you believe that? And it, you know, it was a white house, had white clapboards on it, but it was being used as a silo. And we went on to Massachusetts. Come back in, you know, that's 56 to 96. There's 40 years. And now I'm living in the house that I saw when I was 12 years old.
Without the corn.
Well, we found some corn.
Did you?
Yeah, when we would open up, you know, walls, and we made, you know, some adjustments to everything, we would find corn skeletons, you know, because the little critters would come in there and they'd, you know, eat the corn and stuff like that. Yeah, the next door neighbors, wonderful farmers that lived next to us, the Wieners, they said, oh, it's like those are the people that are living in the poorhouse there, the corn house. Yes. But yeah, it's like this big
circle.
Gettysburg has been a central thing in my life, most of my life, for whatever reason.
Well, Joe, if I may, it seems like in your life you were able to do the things that was closest to your heart.
I've been amazingly blessed. Mm-hmm. And I am one of the least of the musicians in this band. I mean, our singer has a fabulous voice.
Is this the current band?
That is what we looked like in at the 140th Gettysburg. Might have been 2008, maybe. That's my brother in the middle with the cigar clenched in his teeth. Dave is sitting there with his guitar. That's me over there on the right. Greg Hernandez on fife, who's no longer with the band. Joe Whitney, who was one of the new guys, a 20-year man plus. He's still with the band. Mike Paul, who lives in New Oxford.
Yes, you were saying that.
And we met him when he was about 19 years old. He was working at the Dobbins house as an undercook at the time, I think.
Does he still live in New Oxford?
Yeah. Yep, and a very talented player. He's so talented that my brother was able to let him take leads a lot and play harmonies to it. Nobody else does that. Fred is brilliant at that. This is Bob Beeman, who plays the tambo and bones, and a good old buddy there, Tom DiGiuseppe, on the 6-string, 5-string banjo.
Did you start calling yourself the second South Carolina string band when you first started?
From the beginning. my feeling was that, and I've always been fond of, you know, long, long names. I had a jug band once that I thought, well, we called it the Lower Blackwood Street Rag Pickers and Chamber Music Society, so you can see, mm-hmm. you know, and then the title of this, you know, famous, most famous Civil War, blah, 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 and so forth.
And this yeah, was...
That sign was made by Marty Mummert, who has a store here in Gettysburg. Yeah, he said, "What do you, you know, how do you want it to look?" I said, "I want it to look like it was painted the way the soldiers used to write on the Confederate battle flags. They put the, you know, the battle honors on it and stuff, the places they'd fought." And so I just, you know, that's what he came up with, and that became our what do you call it, a cheese board or whatever. And on the backside, we had we would hold, you know, the music or the words to the songs that we were playing. So.
You played steadily for years.
Yeah.
And then you all decided to slow down some.
Well, yeah. I was still up until the age of 75, I guess. I mean, being located in New England, myself, Dave, Bob, and sometimes Tom, the band was starting to, by now we were gaining revenue from, you know, sales, not only physical sales at events, but when we got onto CD Baby, which was a distribution company for independent artists, they said, well, how do you want to distribute this stuff? I said, everywhere, whether we get paid for it or not, just get it out there. You know, there's no such thing as bad publicity or whatever. So we were starting to get revenue, what my brother referred to as mailbox money. And if it wasn't for that, we would have been done, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, because it just got to be too much for everybody to try to travel. Dave had a large family. I had business, you know, requirements and, you know, commitments and stuff like that with illustration jobs. Fred was playing in another band when we were down here and he was still in New England. So there were a lot of different moving pieces. So I started using some of the money to rent 15 passenger vans, and I traveled with what we would call, this is what we call the pop stand. My tent and my brother's tent would be side by side. He had one of the wall tents that had a, you know, it was a half wall tent. And I had a regular regulation sort of wedge tent. And we would both have the dining fly out over the front. So we had about 40 feet across the front, and we would play under in front of my tent, and Fred's wife, Patty, would sell the product in front of their tent. And we did that. We were up on Sutler's Row. Our deal was to try to look as authentic as we could and to sound as authentic as we could after we learned, you know, that the original top 30 Civil War songs were, yeah, okay, they were legit, but we were playing them in an unauthentic way. So by the time we got to the third album, I had learned how to play stroke style, minstrel style banjo, and basically clawhammer style banjo, and which grew out of the stroke style minstrel business. So what happened was, I was warehousing all the CDs, doing all the shipping, trucking all this, you know, a lot of this camp stuff down there. My brother carried all of the sound equipment and stuff, and we would all assemble, you know, at Gettysburg every year. We were essentially the house band for the Gettysburg event from the 131st Gettysburg, with only 2 years off until the 156th Gettysburg, which was the last GAC event. And so I'm getting old, it's getting hard to, you know, to do all this stuff. Dave had some family things that he's an only son, his parents were elderly. It was, the handwriting was on the wall there. Attendance had begun to fall off at some of these events. the authentic, the campaign style reenactment community was growing, and they were doing specific events about specific fights. They didn't have to be big battles. They could be, you know, smaller battles like the cornfield at Antietam or the sunken road at Antietam or things like that. And they would attract men that would sleep just like they did during the war, regardless of the weather. They, you know, slept on the ground. They ate the same kind of food. They marched, you know, the whole thing. And we aren't doing that. It's like, I'm like, okay, I did that once. That was enough. I know it's not good. It's, you know, it's uncomfortable. I'm kind of fond of my creature comforts at my age. So, but it was getting clear that, to me, about 4 years before we dropped the mic, that this was going to have to come to an end. And so, as we came to the 155th Gettysburg, where I hired Mike Wickline to do the video shoot for us. That was in 2018. The October before, at Cedar Creek, somebody set a pipe bomb in one of the settler tents about 60, 70 feet from us. And it didn't go off, but that's only by the grace of God. And so they discovered it. One of the women who was working in there saw it sticking out from underneath one of the tables that she had. And next thing you know, we're all set. We just started our first song and after the battle on Saturday. And we see this guy in a black shirt and khaki pants packing a gun on his hip. And he starts stringing yellow tape across from us. We're like, what's going on with that? The next thing you know, a guy comes over and says, you got to move across, you know, back up there by the road. So we backed up by the road about 50 or 60 feet. Now you got to go across the street to the buildings on the other side. Then the next thing you know, we had to go a quarter mile down the road into a big field. Yeah, because it, you know, and there were still people in the camps and everything. They hustled everybody out, and it was unbelievable. So somebody tried to blow up an event. Cascading consequence to that, the event was canceled. So the next day there wasn't, you know, that was it for Cedar Creek, which is a big event. And Remembrance Day, now by now I'm living in New Hampshire, so I was gone. But in Remembrance Day in 2017, they'll remember here, there were concrete barriers on the streets. There were, you know, the big, you know, earth mover tractors and stuff blocking stuff off. There were, you know, fire trucks and everything. Everything was like super. And then the following year, at the 155th, the liability insurance had skyrocketed. So there were a lot of things going on, and there was still a lot of worries about Antifa and, you know, all of the Confederate stuff is bad, and, you know, this is, so it was pretty clear that it wasn't going to be good. And then in 2019, we only had three gigs, one of which was a standing invitation here for Gettysburg. The other was a private event for the Pennsylvania Bucktails, whom we were friends with, at an event in, east of here, east in Pennsylvania. I can't remember the town off the top of my head. And the other thing was a show on Remembrance Day, Saturday night, I think it was, at the GAR Hall, I think. And so that was all we had for all of inquiries, period. And two of them were, you know, associated with Gettysburg, and one was just an unexpected one-off. And
so you haven't played as a group since?
No, we came back. No, that's right. No, we haven't, except for two times. My brother's wife retired from her job, and they moved to South Carolina, and they came up to do a kind of a farewell tour in New England, because that's where we all had come from. And they came to our house, and we were now living in Wallingford, Connecticut, and they came to our house. All the, you know, the original band guys reconvened, or four of us, and we played on the front porch of our house, you know, a couple of sets, wasn't terrible. Mm-hmm. a year off. And then we did it again for my 80th, and my brother's 76th birthday. It was last year, I think.
Did you, are you coming out of retirement, or are you just announcing your retirement? And this is...
No, we had already made it clear that, because the last album, well, we released two albums. The first one was a broad hint, Strike the Tent. I mean, that's kind of, you know, but that didn't, nobody kind of got it. And so then we did Ain't Dead Yet, an album of all instrumentals. And that was released in, I think, 2017. And, you know, by then we had stopped playing in 2019, and COVID hit, and that was it. That was, you know, there was, if there ever been any doubt, that was the end of that. So, and when people would ask me, I had a sort of a boilerplate cut and paste answer, you know, except for the name, and I changed the name. Sorry, but, you know, sorry, blank, but, uh-huh. You know, due to COVID, you know, political correctness, cancel culture, all that stuff, we, you know, it just was time to drop the mic and say it's been a great ride, but, you know, and we've been blessed, we love you all, but it's time to go. And so how did it come about? We've been friends with Susan and George. George Lomas had been wonderful to us for 25 years, and we loved him. And Susan, we had also known for a long time, and we know how she cared, how much she cared for him. She asked us to come up for a memorial thing, and we did that. We came and did that. But my brother had moved down to South Carolina, and he and his wife, Patty, they've been, you know, featuring Gettysburg ever since 2000. They moved down here, you know, a couple of years after, 4 years after us, and Fred worked for Rob Gibson and for another photographer in town doing photography, and then he was working for the quartermaster, and Patty was working with Cindy Warlick of the Emporium making dresses and items like that for them. So we all knew each other, we all liked each other, we'd all been friends for a long time.
And stayed in traveled. Contact.
Huh?
And you stayed in contact.
Yeah, and especially Cindy, my brother and his wife were on their way up to her son's house in North Carolina for Mother's Day, and the phone rings in the car, and Patty answered the phone, and it was Cindy calling. You know, and say, what would it take to get you guys to, you know, come back to, and Fred didn't want to, you know, that's my bailiwick. And so Fred called me. I think they were still in the car when he called. And I don't think I thought about it for very long. I mean, we all miss it. Mm-hmm. We miss the people at the event more than I think we missed the performing part. Mm-hmm. I mean, we loved that too, but, you know, to talk with the people and have come up to you and feel, you know, just part of a big family, that's always been, you know, what's been what lights my fire. Mm-hmm. And so I got on the phone with Susan and we started talking about doing it. It's like, yeah, I'd absolutely do it as a, I want to do it as a, you know, we all want to do it as a benefit for, you know, to help the Loma Center. If we can do that, that'd be great. And I started thinking, you know, what venue? And it's like, well, we really need to think about this because when the word gets out, I mean, I like I said earlier, there's been a slight uptick in interest and, you know, in inquiries to the Facebook page and Facebook Messenger. And even stuff on the YouTube comments thing. You guys ever getting the band back together, that kind of thing? And, gee, I'm sorry I missed you. And people from Germany, Czechoslovakia, you know, Singapore would leave comments like this. Like, I got one from Kazakhstan, if I can believe it, the other night. And I, yeah, that'd be kind of cool.
This is the last chance.
This would be, I started thinking about what would we call this? And then I thought, well, last gasp, because I've always been proud of the fact we never took ourselves very seriously. I mean, we took the music seriously and the showmanship seriously, but
you know. Had fun.
Come on, yeah. We had a lot.
From the heart.
We had a lot of fun. And I said, we probably need to nail down because Michael said, we can put 60 people in the Loma Center, but, just people we know personally would fill that, pretty quick. The other question I was asking myself, well, how are we going to get ready for this? Because I don't want to stink. If we're going to do this, it's going to have to be good, or I don't want any part of it. And so how would we do that? Well, the way we do that is we practice at home, because he's in South Carolina, I'm in Connecticut, Dave's in Salem, Massachusetts, Bob's in Meriden, Connecticut, Joe Whitney's near Manassas, I can't think of the name, and Mike is here in New Oxford. So how are we gonna do this? Oh, wait. We have all of our music on YouTube at the touch of a couple of keystrokes. Go to the albums, hit the playlist, Chemo Chymo, hit that. We know what key it's in. We can tune our instruments to ourselves, can play along with ourselves as if we were with the band. So that's what everybody is supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And I know I have, and it's there's a lot of muscle memory involved, but it's going to be some work to do that. And we're going to be here for a couple of days before the show to record, not to record necessarily, but to rehearse as a group all together again.
Joe, I have so many more questions to ask you, but we're running out of time. Again, when I have an individual like you who live from the heart, it's easy to talk to.
It's for all of us in the band. It's been a blessing. We don't take any of it for granted. The music that we have made. There's something about it that transcends the sectional difference, the blue, the gray. There's something that goes beyond, because the Yankees like it, the Rebels like it, people in Europe like it, people in Asia like it, people, Brazil like it. We used to think, we must have sold enough CDs to, it's only a maximum of 50,000 people in the hobby. We probably got, most of them have got a CD or two. Mm-hmm. And so, what happens next? Well, that's what happened next. We never saw, we joke, we say, yeah, that's what we planned, just like we planned it.
It's the second South Carolina string band, the most famous Civil War string band in the world. And your music has been in movies and,
we're in
documentaries. All have been too, haven't you?
Well, we went down for the Gettysburg movie, and I managed to make it into that in a very small way in the attack on Little Round Top. I was down here for the filming of that. And we were here for the Pickett's Charge Week, but not as a band. And then we played in Gods and Generals, and that was unbelievable experience. And now it's there, it's part of the movie. We, again, jokingly referred to it as that part of the movie that has the most genuine emotion in it, because everybody's actually having a good time. So even the generals that were sitting in front of us, mm-hmm. it was a lot of fun. And our music has been used in two or three films, and a bunch of Ken Burns's documentaries, not the Civil War one, but...
And people can go to YouTube?
Yep.
And look up the Second South?
You can just type in at Second South Carolina String Band, and it'll take you right to our channel, but you can just type in the YouTube search Second South Carolina String Band, and there it is. It'll take you to the page.
So, Joe, you're a great illustrator.
Well, I don't know about that, but I was an illustrator.
stole the heart of your number one fan.
Yeah.
Bought the
my better 7/8. Yeah.
provided an experience for over 30 years for reenactors to experience the most authentic music.
We tried.
That they could.
We tried.
You've touched many people's lives. Would you like to, this camera here is the one that's on you. Would you like to say something to the people watching before we leave?
But I guess to any of our fans and friends that are watching this, we're grateful for your support and love over the years. We're blessed by it, humbled by it, and we're hoping that this last show will be a worthy contribution to the oeuvre, you know, so.
I'm sure it will.
Well, we'll do the best we can. Mm-hmm. We're a bunch of old coots after all, so.
Mm-hmm. Who knows how to have fun.
Yeah, we do know how to have fun.
And the interesting thing too is you're trying to create an atmosphere at the Gettysburg Middle School.
Yeah.
That would be similar to the way you would play on the field.
Something like you might have seen on a minstrel stage with the footlight kind of things, or around a campfire, the kind of ambience, it's hard to do in a large auditorium, but hopefully we'll be able to pull it off with the sound system, and I hope we'll be able to keep the techno stuff down low enough that that's always been a bugaboo for me, that, you know, it's like I don't want to have a microphone in between me, even though it's necessary, and the crowd. But we'll see how it turns out. We'll do the best we can in that regard. So,
Joe, yours, a true artist in many sense.
Well, okay.
Okay.
I'll do what I can.
Thanks for being here, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks from coming all the way down from the New England states.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
I hope you enjoy your stay.
Always.
One of your hometowns, in Gettysburg.
Always enjoy Gettysburg.
Thanks for watching this segment of Open House here at Community Media. We spent an enjoyable time with Joe Yours, who is one of the founders, if not the founder of...
You were
founded around the campfire.
Yep.
And of the second South Carolina string band. Until we have a chance to bring another wonderful person into our studio here, stay healthy, be kind, and remember, you're the best.
Well, a buckwheat cake was in her mouth and a tear was in her eye. So I said, I'm coming from the south. She said, don't you